When Erica and I bought this old Victorian house in Washington State, we really thought about living the way people lived in the 1800s.
But then our attention was drawn to the rock formation out back.
And we got really interested in the discovery of Homo naledi, this new species of ancient human ancestors.
And they had tiny brains and human-like arms and legs and ape-like torsos. And I said,
you said, Kyle, I think we can do this.
And since then, we've been living as pre-humans.
Most days, we don't talk. We mainly point and grunt.
If we need heat or light, we make fire.
Sometimes, it takes us the whole day.
We're not good at it.
If I were going to use one word to describe the effect of living like cave people...
Mindful. We are more mindful.
That's the word I was going to use. That's amazing.
The little things, they matter more, you know?
Like, where are we going to get food?
Yeah, will this thunderstorm kill us?
Don't poop near the water supply.
He always forgets, no matter how many times I point and grunt about it.
I can be such a knucklehead sometimes.
Some people ask us, do you expect your Homo naledi lifestyle to become a trend?
We say, we don't know. How can we?
Our brains are the size of oranges.
What's a trend? What's a lifestyle?
Kyle, do you want to watch True Detective?
We allow ourselves 1 hour a day to catch up on what we've DVR'd.
Otherwise, we feel kind of left out of conversations.
So let's watch that. But first, I have to check my email.
And I'm posting an essay on Jezebel.com. Why don't the rest of you listen to the nose? And now, he's living as a 3rd century AD Roman gladiator because, well, you know, he really likes gladiators. Colin McEnroe.
And that's my business. I'm not writing any essays about it. In fact, this week a couple, one half of a couple, wrote an essay on Vox. Think about this. Somebody who says that she and her husband are living as Victorians, living Victorian lives. So she wrote an essay on Vox. I mean, the Victorians, I think they had Slate and maybe Salon. They definitely did not have Vox. So that's wrong right there. Anyway, we probably will get to that as we go along here. We're certainly also going to talk about some fairly boorish things that were said to Serena Williams and about Carlina Fiora or whatever her name is, about sort of what's on their faces. But we're going to begin with where kind of everybody's beginning. First of all, let me introduce the panel. With us today is James Hanley, one of the founders and the supreme being of Trinity Cine Studio. Also with us is a comedian, actress, impresario, dancer, I don't know, I give up, everything. Carolyn Bain. And Teresa Kramer is with us, one of the founders of The Cut, a magazine for people from Connecticut in their early adult years, except maybe not anymore.
I'm not my early adult years.
Who knows? Yeah, who knows? It's just for a cohort of grumpy people from Connecticut who are gradually aging and eventually perish. And they'll be like the Homo naledi. People will study them later. See, why didn't they enjoy it more? Why didn't they have a better time? So we are going to begin where everything begins this week, and that, of course, is with the advent of the new Colbert show. One critic, James Poniewozik in the New York Times, says, but as overstuffed and messy as this new late show could be, big is a refreshing goal at a time when late-night shows have been redefined as content creators for your phone. It is maybe the biggest slight and highest compliment to say that none of the episode's best bits seemed especially viral. Now, that was when he was writing about the first episode. Since then, other things have happened. There have only been 3 episodes, but it's kind of amazing how much really has happened. But maybe let's begin at the beginning. We'll hear a little bit from Colbert's opening monologue.
Thank you for all joining me for my first episode of The Late Show With, starring Stephen Colbert. I am he. You are all witnessing television history, and like most history, it's not on the History Channel. And I am so excited to be here right now. I am also so excited to be at home 6 hours from now watching this on TV. Hi, me. Hey. Hi, Steven. Don't tell me how it went. I'm watching this later. No spoilers. And folks, we've been working so hard, so very hard to get the show ready for you. And I have to say, as long as I have 9 months to make 1 hour of TV, I could do this forever.
All right. So as we go along here a little bit later, we're going to talk about specific things that happened on the show, most especially this rather remarkable exchange with Joe Biden last night and a disruption that you didn't see last night as the founder of Uber was on and there were people in the audience who were cabbies or related to cabbies who were unhappy with that and made themselves heard and known at the taping. But just for starters, we want to kind of get the panel's feeling about how things are going. Stephen Colbert's remarkable. He's unusual. He's really kind of not like other late-night hosts. On the other hand, James Hanley, first shows are really hard. I mean, maybe I can say that more authoritatively than anyone else here, but first shows are really hard. And, you know, notwithstanding his joke, having 9 months to do a series of early shows is almost a disadvantage, I think.
Yeah, I think you're exactly right. I mean, I think that if anything – my first impression was that it was kind of overworked and kind of self-conscious in a way. I mean, I think that Stephen Colbert is – I mean, everybody knows he's a highly intelligent man, and he is really capable of extraordinary insight, and playing his characters and or not playing his characters can sometimes be hard to figure out. And I mean, I feel my impression, first of all, is that it's interesting. I was a little not impressed over the week, but it was interesting to see, and I want to see how he develops. I really do see that it's something that's a trajectory, you know, trying things out. But one of the things that I think bothers me in general is that we really have so few incisive and interesting commentators on the political scene generally, but on the social scene as well. I feel a little sort of regretful that this man who was so good at that and is still good at it, I think, but it's been transformed into something that's really, well, a late show based on other things like celebrity, you know, a sort of a different kind of relationship, which actually is part of the problem, I think, in that I found myself thinking, you know, is he still actually playing his character but with another overlay maybe? I just can't quite make it out really just yet. But I feel that it's turned his whole sort of intelligence is not being expressed through this. That was where my disappointment is. But I would give it a chance because there's certainly, as you pointed out, Colin, that there are a number of things that in the interviews that actually had really interesting repercussions and revealed things that probably wouldn't have happened otherwise.
Yeah, I mean, before I go to the other panelists, I want to say that sometimes what I was feeling, and it's similar to what you just said, is that they feel like they need so much more than just Stephen Colbert and how smart and funny and interesting he is. And you almost feel like Colbert thinks that too. And it's maybe for the show to find its groove, they've got to trust him more, trust a little bit more what he's really kind of capable of on his own. But Theresa Grammer, it does seem as though one of the things he is trying to do is see how much he can stretch the frame of what a late night TV show is. Like, what's a good guest? What's an appropriate week of guests? What else can you do?
Yeah. I think I didn't come to the show with as much baggage as some other people because I haven't had cable for like 6 years. And so I didn't watch the old show with any regularity. I saw clips online. And when someone was like, oh, Colbert had a really great night, I'd watch it. So I don't have as many expectations for him. And the thing I came away with was like, this guy is an old fashioned entertainer. Like, he can do everything. He's going to come out singing and dancing. He's going to end the show that way. And he's going to do whole skits in the middle that are, I mean, he's an actor as, you know, Letterman's not an actor. Leno wasn't an actor. Jimmy Fallon can barely keep a straight face. But Stephen Colbert, you know, he can do a lot of things, and he's trying to cram all of that into a show. And, you know, I fall asleep after, like, the first 15 minutes of any late-night show anyway, so I don't really care. You just cram everything in there, and I'm fine with that because I'm not going to see the interviews anyway. But I did also have the same thought that you did, Colin, that the guests were interesting because they weren't straight up people just pitching movies. You know, there were, I mean, Elon Musk, who really wants to talk to him on a late night show? I thought that was really interesting.
Yes, I mean, the first three shows have included Elon Musk and also the founder of Uber. These are not typical choices for late night shows. No. Before I go to Caroline, I wanted just to say if you have thoughts that you want to share, 860-275-7266, 860-275-7266, or please feel free to tweet at us at WNPR Colin. Our tweetmaster, Greg Hill, is waiting for your tweet at WNPR Colin. So, Carolyn, and I go to you as our comedian. I mean, the first and foremost, the thing he's got to do is he's got to be funny. And he's got to be funny in a slightly different way than he was on cable, right? He's got to be funny. I mean, it's I mean, we saw that it was not enough to have some funny clips of Donald Trump and riff on them or anything like that, that there had to be a frame put on that, which was the craving for Oreos.
Yeah, yeah. his binge of Oreos made me, and I'm sure many other people, run out and need Oreos. I'm not sure if that was what his tactic was there. I also was excited because under his desk he had like Sabra like hummus pretzel dip and Oreos. I was like, I want to get under that desk. But he from the moment he came out, like Teresa said, he's singing, he's dancing, and he looks so happy. Mm. I don't think I'd ever seen Stephen Colbert smile like that. And that, I thought, was just a great thing for him as a performer. Like, he truly looked like he was just living in that moment. And it was kind of that drop of that character that we had come to know. And, I mean, I hadn't watched late-night talk shows in a long time. Like, probably, you know, like 15 years. Like, Jay Leno, David Letterman were still big things. And I just hadn't really – I kind of had forgotten the whole format. So I felt like I was sort of – getting back into it, watching him. And I was so disappointed in the first episode, in everything. I thought his opening monologue just lacked anything topical other than the topic of himself taking this over. And then, you know, he sat down and he did have the funny bit with the Oreos, but there wasn't, it just, I wasn't laughing the way that I wanted to be.
Right. There's a labored quality to some of the comedy.
It did.
At first. I mean, the bit with Clooney on the first show where he promoted a movie that didn't exist and they kept cutting back to it. And one of the things that they are doing a lot of right now is sort of a lot of repetition in a bit that's not that good in the first place.
Sometimes with comedy, yeah. That is like, you know, the first time it's kind of funny. The second time you're like, oh, no. By the third time it's starting to wear. And by the fourth time it's hilarious.
Right.
And that can be a comedy tactic. But it just didn't. It didn't work here.
They did the same thing last night with Colbert. This was, I thought, a very flimsy conceit, saying he didn't care about football, he wouldn't be ruled by football, and then all these sort of aging football players came out one by one, and you know.
To me, that felt the same as the Sabra hummus and pretzel dip joke. It was as if like that was dictated to be there by
yeah,
a network,
yeah.
And
yes, yeah.
I felt like he is still struggling with how to. Work with those network confines of having to plug things and having to have things be part of what he's saying.
I liked the Sabra hummus bit. It reminded me a lot of what Tina Fey used to do on 30 Rock, where she was sort of making fun of having to have product placement. And he was, you know, he was making a comment on even having to do it in the first place. Mm-hmm. And I do – normally I would be watching Jimmy Kimmel. I watched Colbert for the show this week, but I would normally be watching Jimmy Kimmel, and he has bits where he has to do that sort of stuff. It'll be like the Bud Light Lime thing or something, and he'll, you know, ask dumb questions to a celebrity while sitting at a bar or something, and hand them shots of whoever's. And so I thought that Stephen Colbert did a better job of addressing the fact that pretty much all of them have this at this point.
Well, yep. James, in our emails, I know, and so we're getting into the James Hanley sweet spot right now, which is corporate control. And so there's a delicate line that he's treading, you know, or right. a knife's edge that he's running his thumb down. Right. And it's, you know, I can laugh about this, but I am pretty beholden to it. I could put Les Moonves in the front row, the head of CBS in the front row, with a little joke about how he can toggle back to some other show if he doesn't like what he's seeing. But he's joking about some kind of actual reality.
Right, and I found that downright creepy, actually, that particular episode. when he introduces the guy who's really sort of, you know, the head honcho, and he actually has a sort of censorship button there. And I think that this whole thing about product placement, for example, is to a certain extent on his show, on his original show, he was able to do product placement in a kind of self-deprecating way that he also interspersed with fake products and also did things with products that you could imagine that the salespeople were cringing about. And that there doesn't seem to be that quality about even the thing with the Oreos to a certain extent. You know, it has a serious side to it. And I do think that you've got a different situation here. There's a lot of money riding on this show. This is a late show. This is a flagship show for CBS. They've spent a huge amount of money on the theater, and you know, I don't doubt Colbert's sincerity in what he's doing. And I do think that perhaps if he sort of toes the line a little bit, maybe in the first month or so, he'll get himself well known and then he'll start to change the way he runs the show. I hope that that's the case. But I certainly think that the whole sort of corporate presence there is pretty obvious. And it doesn't it sort of feels creepy to me that here's somebody who could come on and appear, although I'm sure it wasn't entirely spontaneous. He could appear on his original show as being dodging from one thing to another and changing subjects and putting people who he was interviewing on a sort of, you know, like they didn't know whether, is he being serious? Is he his character? Can I answer this question? There's a sort of edginess there that he is capable of conveying but didn't in this first week.
I think the other struggle is, I mean, and this is why another reason that first shows are hard. If to do this well, you have to create the illusion that you are the most relaxed person in the room. So if you think about Johnny Carson, I mean, Johnny Carson is the epitome of all this, and that was his vibe, right? I'm the most relaxed person in the room. In fact, he was this tremendous control freak. But you know, what you saw was this person affecting this attitude of nonchalance. Letterman took it in a different direction, sort of saying, whatever your feelings about the quality of this show may be, my feelings about it are even lower and more disparaging than yours. I am less interested, you know, and more contemptuous of, you know, everything that this show represents than you are. So, I mean, there are sort of various ways to do it. But Colbert, because he's very much sort of a part of the meritocracy, right? You know, the whole thing, as both of you were just saying, he can sing, he can dance, he's funny, he can act, he's done Sondheim, you know. and so what he came out with, I thought, was more energy than I could really handle at that time of day. Maybe it kept you up an extra 5 minutes.
I made it through the entire first show. I made a point. I didn't get too comfortable. I made sure I watched the entire first one. But after that, I was, you know.
The first one was actually almost exhausting. I didn't even stay awake to watch it. I had to watch it the next morning on my DVR.
He comes across as a little manic, in a way that came out.
He was so, I feel like he just had so much of that energy, and the crowd was really egging him on.
Yeah. Nuremberg rallies way that I'm not entirely comfortable with.
It was a little overwhelming, and to use James's word, creepy.
Well, there's also this, I mean, no other host has had this kind of hype really about taking over a show because he already had a following. Right. Like, no one really cared when Jimmy Fallon took over, you know, like.
And I think that he felt that pressure to create something and to have like a brand new shtick that everyone is going to. You know, that people are going to be talking about and that is going to kind of give him a spot in something that is sort of a fading, I think, in a lot of ways, a fading, archaic element.
One of the things I was wondering, too, is if this is, I guess we're hearing no because you guys don't really like this, but I was thinking he's a very good solution to the Fallons and the Kimmels of the world because, you know, forever, like my mom did not get Conan O'Brien. She was just like, he is not funny. I don't understand why anyone thinks he's funny. And I was like, he's hilarious. I don't know. And Jimmy Fallon is so clearly talking to like our generation with his, you know, the history of rap and all these things he does and talking about, you know, the Saved by the Bell reunion and those sort of things. But Colbert's got a much more sophisticated approach to all of this. He's out there like, you know, bringing Mavis Staples out there and singing with her, and I'm sure that somewhere my mom was like, yeah, this is awesome.
I didn't know who she was.
I didn't know.
These things are forgivable. Well, one of the things we know about Colbert is that he has a depth, and if you read the interviews with him, this is an extraordinarily thoughtful guy who's very, very well educated, as Teresa just said, very sophisticated, and capable of going to some places where you just don't see people in this particular theater go to or much of anywhere else. And so Joe Biden was on last night. And the exchange they had was not only something that you can't imagine happening on any other late night television show, it's almost something you can't imagine happening with anybody else who under any circumstances might be interviewing Joe Biden. Let's just hear the first clip where he's talking about his son, Beau, who, as most people know, recently died of brain cancer.
I was hoping you could tell us a story about him. The president, in his eulogy, called your son Joe 2.0. In what way is that a compliment to you?
You know, my dad had an expression. He used to say, you know your success as a parent when you turn and look at your child and realize they turned out better than you. I was a hell of a success. My son was better than me. And he was better than me in almost every way. The thing about Bo was, from the time he... another expression my dad had was, never complain and never explain. I never one single time, my word as a Biden, ever heard my child complain. When he was in that accident, lost his mom and his sister, he was very badly injured. Almost every bone in his body broken. He was in a cast from his ankles, both legs, his chest, his arms. I used to carry him around with a hook in his back. And my other son, Hunter, his best friend, a year and a day younger, was just about three and had a severe skull fracture. And he'd sit in the room in the hospital, and he'd turn and he'd say, Hunt, look at me. Look at me. I love you. I love you. 4 years old. Nothing changed. A couple months before he died, I was at his house, and he said, Dad, sit down. I want to talk to you. With Hallie, his wife, incredible kid. And he said, Dad, I know how much you love me. He said, you got to promise me something. Promise me you're going to be all right. Because no matter what happens, Dad, I'm going to be all right. Promise me.
So this whole exchange takes place with quite a bit of moisture forming in the vice president's eyes, and I think also in Colbert's eyes. It's a very emotionally raw kind of moment, and in just a second we'll play you a little bit more of it because they get into the question of their commonalities. But I don't know, maybe I'm alone in thinking this. I mean, James, it did strike me as though, I mean, obviously Jimmy Fallon, Jimmy Kimmel, these are, I mean, Jimmy Kimmel cries all the time, but but these are, or Letterman or Leno or almost anybody you could think of. I just, you know, so much of late night television is about kind of keeping this level of bonhomie, you know, up there. And he's just so, he was so ready not to do that.
Yeah, I think that was an extraordinary moment of television, really. That, I mean, I think it relied on something unique, which is Joe Biden. I think that he's an extraordinarily honest and forthright person when he starts talking. And sometimes it gets him in trouble, but in talking about himself and his family, I mean, that was a visceral and moving expression of how he felt. And it almost seemed like, I mean, I think that Stephen Colbert can be credited for, you know, his sort of gentle questioning and bringing it out. But it seemed almost like, what is this on this show kind of thing? I mean, it was like totally blew me out of the water. I thought this is almost like there's nothing behind this than an extraordinary expression that doesn't fit in this show that has been structured as an entertainment show, and that's not detracting from it in its veracity and its really extraordinarily moving quality. I mean, I think those moments that whole interview was really amazing. Joe Biden is one of the very few political figures who actually engages people on that kind of level. And you can listen to him talk about his family and you just feel that emotion from him and that sense of connection. And in a way, it's an absolute 180-degree contrast with the nature of Stephen Colbert's origin as a character. And that is probably the most fascinating lesson of the week for me.
Yeah, I mean, I had so many thoughts about this, but it does seem to me, well, I mean, Teresa, you talk about how you've used late night television the way that it was traditionally used in the past. Mm-hmm. People use it to kind of fall asleep too, right? It's kind of the last thing you see. And so it was for a long time created and programmed that way so that it wouldn't be disruptive. It wouldn't give you bad dreams. It wouldn't give you, you know. And then, you know, we sort of entered this era where there was as Poniewozik says, I mean, Fallon and Kimmel started thinking, well, people watch things at all kinds of times and getting something to go viral, you know, on your phones. That's maybe another way to win the game. But I don't know what, you know, what, I mean, this seemed more like an attempt to really create a truly enduring moment that you could, you know.
It did, because, you know, if that had appeared on Ellen at 4 o'clock in the afternoon, I don't think there would have been anything all that shocking about it. I mean, I can't watch Ellen without crying. She's always giving some poor family something. And so But I was sitting there thinking, I mean, I know they must have had a discussion beforehand about how far Biden was willing to go, but I was like, Stephen, leave him alone. He's going to, like, start
sobbing. I felt
sobbing.
So uncomfortable at early in the interview with the questions because, I mean, although, like you said, to his credit, he did a great job prodding and in a very respectful way. It was a wonderfully done interview. Mm-hmm. But at the same time, I just wanted to be like, oh, I think it's too soon. Yeah. Just let him smile and say something glib. And I wanted to gloss over it at first. But then as it went, I became more comfortable with it. And I thought it was remarkable how to see Stephen Colbert interact with someone in that light.
And his true talent to be able to do that and to remain sort of plain folks and not make it about himself during that interview.
Although Biden turned it back to him, too. And I guess we don't have time to play this clip. But so there is a moment where Biden kind of turns it around and says, and you start to realize these guys are very similar in certain ways. First of all, they're both active practicing Catholics. Colbert takes his own Catholicism very seriously. And you also realize that they are people whose lives have been scarred by horrible tragedy, not only the death of Beau Biden, but obviously the accident to which he refers, in which he lost a wife and children. Colbert, of course, also at a very young age, lost his father and siblings in this plane crash. And so Biden turns it around and says, you know, you and I, we've been through the same. Yeah. And they start to talk about this. And once again, I found myself thinking, I can't think of an analog to this. I mean, the only analog I can think of is that, you know, that Dick Cavett, and I have sort of mixed feelings about Dick Cavett, but Cavett tended, and there's this movie out right now, The Best of Enemies, you know, Cavett tended to have these kind of real things that would happen that people would then talk about sometimes for decades on his show. And maybe that's in there somewhere. Yeah, what were you going to say?
There was this episode of Jimmy Kimmel. When Jimmy Kimmel first started, his sidekick on the show was his Uncle Frank. Mm-hmm. And so one year, a few years in, over summer break, Uncle Frank died. And when Jimmy came back to the show, the first episode was just dedicated to Uncle Frank. It was an entire monologue about how wonderful he was. And Jimmy's crying because he's always crying about something. And then the Uncle Frank had at one point been a security guard in Las Vegas. And one of his favorite acts there was Don Rickles. So Don Rickles was the only guest on the show that day. And they just sat there and talked about Uncle Frank and all their adventures together. And, you know, it was not about the guest on the show. It was a little bit different, but it was the same sort of raw emotion where, you know, Jimmy had the family in the audience. Everybody's crying. Like, the audience was probably crying because they liked Uncle Frank, too, from watching the show. And that was the closest thing I could come to.
Well, then you can also think of Letterman with Dan Rather when he chokes up after 9/11. And Letterman also when he got very emotional about his own heart surgery. I mean, this does happen. It doesn't usually happen in the third episode. And so we're going to just go to break in just a second. But, Caroline, I'm going to let you have the last word. And that is, I mean, for comedians, there is kind of a question of how much can you toggle out of your comic persona and then get your comic persona back? Because really, you know, Colbert, he wasn't really willing to throw in the towel on the comic element of the show even at that point. And I thought he showed some real nimbleness in his ability to be so genuinely emotional and then even get kind of a comic vibe back too.
Yeah, I think that Biden really played well against him with that too. And I was just amazed that, like you said, a comedian could be raw with that and keep it from going too far in either way. And I thought what was so tasteful, it didn't have that feel the whole time. I didn't think it was something that was staged to go viral. Mm-hmm. It was not something, it obviously has and is something that people will talk about. But, you know, the temptation to be so early into your show and to make a mark, I mean, it did make a mark, but in a remarkable way that makes me want to watch now because I want to see how he's going to interact with people and who he's going to choose to have on and who he'll choose to interact with.
All right. Well, we know Trump is coming up, I think, on the 27th or something. Anyway, we have to take a break right now. This is John Batiste, who's doing an interesting parallel thing, which is running a kind of remarkable band there parallel to Colbert on the show. So I thought we had wrapped up the Colbert thing, and then I was reminded by the guests that we sort of haven't because another remarkable thing happened. And it's a thing that didn't happen on screen, but it is very interesting in its own right, which is that one of his guests last night was the founder of Uber. And it turned out that there were in the audience cab drivers who were there and who began disrupting the interview and shouting. And so we don't see – first of all, one thing that Panawozek has talked about with Colbert is it's taking him 2 hours or more to tape these shows. But so there's a lot of editing that goes on. But this one woman who kind of tweeted out the whole thing talked about how Colbert really kind of kept control of the situation, calmly touched the arm of the guest, quieted both him and the cab driver in the balcony. This woman tweets, "It was truly remarkable to see how Stephen handled the whole interview. He could easily have had the men removed, but instead he truly listened to what they had to say and directly incorporated their concerns into the interview completely smoothly. It was incredible to see how—" Well, anyway, she goes on and on. But and she says he had complete control over the entire theater. The audience, the band, the crew were all confused, a little scared. But Stephen calmed and quieted everyone. He didn't call for security. He just dealt with the men and continued. The tragedy here, James, is that we don't really get to see that.
No, I mean, can you imagine a more compelling piece of television, really, that except perhaps for the Biden interview? I mean, here was a golden chance, really, to show Stephen Colbert's talents, for one. But I think it's an extraordinary moment to actually not just have a sort of celebrity guest, the founder of Uber, that, you know, he's there and sort of, you know, just by his very presence as an individual, he's kind of being celebrated for what he's done. And then there's people in the audience whose lives have been disrupted. And however much you might criticize either party, the fact that you could have an interplay with the audience of that kind, I mean, I would think that, you know, you couldn't get something better to really hook people and see what Stephen Colbert is really like and see how to manage a dynamic like that. I mean, it would have been perfect. To cut it out, to me, just seems absolutely, what were they thinking?
Yeah, I wondered why, too, and I have two reasons that I came up with. Well, three. One is just time. The other one is that it would have drawn from Biden, maybe, to have that. You know, producers and editors thought. And then the third thing, comedians and hecklers from the audience are just not two things that go well. Even though they weren't heckling Colbert, yeah, there's an instinct in you when you hear shouting from an audience that, you know, and the fact that he dealt with it very, very well, it just, you know, shows his experience. But I think that might be part of it.
Well, I was also thinking that the guy is probably not mic'd. It may not have seemed all that compelling when it's just like nonsense in the audience that you can't really hear anyway. And then, you know, if the guy had been in a conversation with him, that would be one thing. But when it's just sort of noise coming from the audience, it may not have actually come across well on screen, because they could just as easily go viral by releasing that now.
Well, yeah. That's true. But mm-hmm. I mean, in this particular case, Kalanick is a person who is like, he's a very controversial figure in mm-hmm. lots of ways to do with Uber. It's not, and so he's being invited on the show, and that's already giving him a sort of like prearranged kind of exposure, that's saying about, you know, what he's doing and sort of celebrating, okay, this young person has come along and started this new business, and he gets to talk about it. But I think that he's created enough of a sense of like recalibrating our sense of how things work. Like, for instance, if you start a business, you don't get to do it without doing things like playing on a fair field by saying, okay, I don't have to pay insurance. You could pay the insurance. Insurance is a big thing for cab drivers, and the fact that you know, individuals are in a situation where it's all being put on them by this sort of starry-eyed corporation kind of thing that is doing this, that meant that somebody challenging it from the audience like that had a very different significance, I think. Mm-hmm. And that's why I think it would have been interesting, because it really bothers me when, even with somebody like Elon Musk, I mean, Elon Musk is interesting, but there are also issues that can be discussed that you rely on maybe for Stephen Colbert, but to ask the difficult questions. But I'm not sure that the really difficult questions were getting asked of Kalanick, and the audience did. And that's probably something really uncomfortable for CBS, and also uncomfortable for the structure of the show. I understand that.
Although the woman did tweet that that he Colbert did rephrase what the man said and posed
yes,
as a question.
Yeah, but I think you know the fact that you could see where that was coming from would have been important. I think.
Yeah.
I think the it also raises that question or brings us back to the question: what will the show be like after 50 or 100 episodes? Because here, what you're seeing now is, you know, in all the ways that you guys have been saying, there's a lot of money and planning that's gone into this, and so one of the things that they're probably not all that open to is the unplanned thing. Even though this sounds like it really was a great unplanned thing, and with 5 or 6 hours of editing time, they probably could have done something with that moment. But it is, you know, I mean, Teresa, I feel as though he probably does, you know, for all the joking about feeling the hot breath of Leslie Moonves on his neck in the first episode, he does feel that, like, okay, our plan didn't really work. Something else happened that we kind of like and are fascinated by and want to be open to. So we're going to cut all the football players, you know,
right.
And we're going to cut this other stuff that we tried and wasn't really all that funny. And we're going to go with this very unplanned thing. I don't know if they have the traction yet to do that, but I almost think maybe at some point he will.
Yeah, I mean, it seems to me that there's so much hype around the show already. And in order to keep the Colbert Report audience, you want to challenge, but that's what people are expecting, right? And for CBS to sort of muzzle that, or I don't know what the right word would be, is sort of silly. He's got a huge audience and people are very excited about him, and to just let him do what he's going to do seems like the right move, and maybe they just don't know how to do that yet. But it's not like Letterman was.
I think it's going to be a bit of a climb. Mm-hmm. I think that just from Tuesday to Thursday was it was totally different. Mm-hmm. So I think it's going to be interesting to see by next week and the week after. Mm-hmm. I think as they start to kind of loosen their grip and he starts to find his footing, mm-hmm. I think that a show will develop that's going to be very different and I hope really good.
I think it kind of has to. I'm going to just wrap this up with one of my usual kind of media theory drums. So, I mean, you have to sort of think about the evolution of television. What was television? To Don Draper, it was a piece of furniture, right? You know, you just sort of – it happens to be a talking piece of furniture, but you don't expect that much from it. You know, Don Draper knows that. He's making these crappy commercials that go on there. You know, and it's – so when you had Jay Leno holding up a piece of cardboard with a little label taped to the back of it and a photo on the front of it, I mean, people, their expectations are low. They're up in their bedroom where they have their not as good television set, their 1080p TV sets downstairs, you know, and so your low production values and kind of dumb jokes that was all fine in a certain era. And then things got kicked up a little bit and people have really good TV sets in their bedrooms. And so the production values had to go up and it had to be a little bit more polished form of entertainment. Now, people's relationship with television, I think they're going to expect it more and more to be like a computer, something that they can really interact with, something that they can get all kinds of interesting information, memorable information out of, that they can pick and choose and make appointments with. And as a result, you have to develop a different TV product to go on people's different expectations for the device they're using. All right, we have to shift gears for it very quickly. We won't be able to cover everything. We might not be able to make fun of the Victorians. But, you know, a couple of interesting moments this week that involved women and their faces. One of them was Donald Trump being quoted in Rolling Stone. I can bring up the quote for you in just a second, but he's watching Carly Fiorina on television and saying basically that he doesn't think somebody with a face like that. He says, look at that face. Would anyone vote for that? Can you imagine that? The face of our next president. There's laughter in the room, but it grows halting and faint behind him. I mean, she's a woman. I'm not supposed to say bad things. But really, folks, come on. Are we serious? And the other one has to do with Serena Williams being asked at a press conference after her victory over her sister at the U.S. Open why she's not smiling. And she basically says that she doesn't really feel – well, she says it's 11:30. To be perfectly honest with you, I don't want to be here. I just want to be in bed right now. And I have to wake up early to practice, and I don't want to answer any of these questions. And you keep asking me the same questions. It's not really – you're not making it super enjoyable. James, I think you did come up with sort of a way of connecting these two little news items.
Well, yeah, I mean, I think that there's a I thought, by the way, the Serena Williams interview was really great. I mean, I think that her expressions, I mean, when you talk about facial expressions and conveying how you really feel, that was perfect. It was a textbook example. But I think that there's this issue all the time that, you know, of course you could be sure that Trump would do this, is to somehow devalue women in a way that is about male insecurity, which is that, you know, women are supposed to smile, they're supposed to be always on stage. And for instance, the most threatening thing probably to Trump about Carly Fiorina, for whatever you might think about her proposed policies or whatever, she can actually answer a question and talk seriously about it and not look like she's trying to get her way by, you know, guile or smiling or any of
just
the stereotypes.
Trump making fun of somebody's facial expressions to me was so – I was like, oh, come on.
One of my favorite responses that I saw to it was, I think it must have been a tweet or something, was someone saying, you know, has anyone shown Trump his own face?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, his answer to this kind of touches back to what we were talking about with Colbert. He says, many of those comments are made as an entertainer. Yeah. Because I did The Apprentice, and it was one of the top shows on television.
That's a good Trump impression.
Some comments are made as an entertainer, and everybody said as an entertainer is a much different ballgame.
Well, that that comes also in the whole dispute he had with Megyn Kelly of Fox, you know, that, mm-hmm. that Fox actually makes a whole thing about turning women into symbols that it uses for its image, and somehow this is supposed to show their particular sort of, you know, like their ability to display the news they want. And so you have somebody like Megyn Kelly who actually then suddenly turns around and starts to develop her own questions or her own personality, and somehow that has broken that idea of the well-made up smiling, you know, the female news reader who is actually, you know, just a front for the news, that this is actually somebody who might be thinking about something and asking a question. And it makes people like Donald Trump very uncomfortable. And there's a whole raft of people running in this primary who are males who are really uncomfortable about women having that kind of connection.
I think it also raises some real questions just as we wrap up, and I want to get a couple of comments here from them too, is, you know, about like what women are allowed to be anywhere. I mean, James, in the history of movies, the sort of brooding, smoldering male archetype is so big. You know, there's just decades and decades and decades of that idea. And there isn't really a counterpoised version of that for women. You know, if you're brooding, you're like Carrie Matheson in Homeland. You basically are, you know, right on the edge of needing hospitalization, you know. So apparently what you're supposed to do after you beat your sister in this grueling tennis match that has used every ounce of energy is say, hi, I just beat my sister in this really grueling. I mean, it's kind of, you're not allowed to be brooding as a woman.
Well, you're not allowed to not smile. I'm always on the show talking about street harassment for some reason. I think I've talked about it like three times on here. But one of the most annoying comments you get as a woman is, oh, just smile. It's like, no, I don't. This happened to me once, no lie, when I was leaving work because my grandfather had just died. And I forever held it against the security guard who said this to me, because I was like, are you? No. He was like, smile. It's going to be okay. I was like, my grandfather just died. I hate you, for the rest of the time I work there. But people do this to you all the time. And it's like, no, it's 7 o'clock in the morning. I don't want to smile. I'm tired. And people will not let you just be.
Yeah,
it's not even unhappy. It's just like, I'm not smiling at you. Like, I don't even know what's happening.
I was sitting backstage on an opening night once, and I was just sitting there, like, we're about to go on, and the director comes by, and everyone is, you know, it was musical theater. It was Hello, Dolly. Mm-hmm. So everyone's, like, bouncing around, singing show tunes before we even have to go sing more show tunes. And the director comes by, and he's like, Carolyn, it's opening night. Like, aren't you excited? And I'm like, I am excited.
Did you give him your resting bitch face?
Yeah, I did. And all right, he just could not. He was like, I don't think you can go on stage. He's like, trying to pet. But sometimes you're like, I just want to not be here right now. Yeah. I just need to rest my smile.
We've got to go to break here, or I'll be looking at Kyan Wolf's non-resting bitch face. So we'll take a break. We'll be back with endorsements.
Smile, though your heart is aching. Smile, even though it's breaking. When there are clouds in the sky.
How come nobody ever mentions the fact that Donald Trump is a flaming homo Naledi? Not only is his brain the size of an orange, but it leaked all over his hair. Today's show was produced by Colin McEnroe and me, Kyone Wolf, with extra help from executive producer Katie Tolarski. Greg Hill appeared in the intro and tweets for us at WNPR Colin. Our interns are Amanda Gallagher and Sarah Flaherty. The part of Bill Curry was played by Venus Williams. For show pages, articles, and videos of the Faith Middleton Show staff loosening their Victorian corsets so they can eat more pizza, visit our website, WNPR.org/Colin. On Monday, the Scramble looks at what Americans can do to help Syrians. And now, back to Colin.
All right, time for endorsements. We'll have to go somewhat briskly through them, but James, what have you got?
Very quickly, at Sydney Studio on Sunday, Monday, and Tuesday, we're showing Testament of Youth, the James Kent film with Alicia Vikander. It's based on Vera Brittain's memoir of being a young woman growing up at the time of the First World War. Really amazing evocation of the time. Really highly recommended.
All right. What have you got, Teresa?
In the vein of these Victorian people, I would like to endorse a series of shows. I believe they were BBC shows, but they were also on PBS, and you can get some of them on DVD through Netflix, at least the last time I checked. And there was, you know, Colonial House and Frontier House and they called it 1900s House, but it was Victorian House. And there were some other ones, 1940s House, where people are forced to live as though they live in this time period. And my personal favorite was Frontier House, in which the women realized how awful it would have been to have to have lived at that time.
Right.
I will be watching all of those.
Me too.
all weekend. I am endorsing Hartford Fashion Week. Hartford's going to have its first ever Fashion Week coming up. I believe it's the first week in October. And I will be emceeing one of the runways. Don't know why I'm doing that. I don't really – not really a fashion person. But and I know Kyone Wolf is emceeing one of the other runways. And it should be really fun and neat to support some local designers and artists. So hope to see everyone there.
All right. Hartford. I'm having a hard time even picturing Hartford Fashion Week, but it'll happen somehow.
It's going to happen.
It's normal.
All right. So I'm going to endorse – I don't think I've ever done this before. I'm going to endorse a Twitter account, and it's called Bakun. Does anybody here follow Bakun?
I think I've heard of it.
Yeah, Bakun is a dog with a T-shirt on, and he's – whoever is behind it has – and it really is often politically incorrect and certainly as his choice of language and imagery is maybe not going to be for everybody. But a lot of it's also just very surreal. Bakun's take on the world is very surreal. So, for example, this week one of his tweets was, "The football player in exile slices open a football with his long pinky nail and sucks out the sports air from it, deflating it completely." He tweeted, "I'd just like to buy a book and look at a painting and eat a sandwich in an underground night mall for people who choose to live poorly." Another one was, "They installed a police hologram outside art museum that's open while the sun is down to scare away night walkers and the mentally ill." Another one was, "Wow, Kathy Griffin, stop. My parents will be home soon." And he actually had quite a bit of fun also. Bakun does not always explain what it is that he's talking about. A couple of times this week he was pretty clearly tweeting about these two people who live in Washington State and are attempting to be Victorians. But he didn't explain that exactly. You sort of had to know. All right. So we're going to wrap things up here. I want to thank James Hanley from Trinity Cine Studio. I will be seeing Testament of Youth. I've been really looking forward to the release of this movie. And Cine Studio is the place to hear it. I want to mention that Grayson Hugh, who you're singing in the background right there, has a new CD out. We're going to be doing something with that in the next week or two. I want to thank Teresa Kramer. Absolutely have to check out The Cut, a magazine for people from Connecticut who are just exactly as annoyed as you are. And Carolyn Payne, if I tried to list everything that Carolyn Payne is, where is there one other thing you're doing? You're at the casino? You're not at the casino?
I am done with the casino for right now.
All right.
But just, you can go on CarolynPayne.com and find where I'm next.
CarolynPayne.com. Click schedule and you'll find out where she's going to be. Thanks to all of you who are for listening. We will be back on Monday. And we will be telling you a little bit about what we can do for Syrian refugees.
I can't believe we actually started a fire.
I know, right?
Oh, did you bring the whiskey?
Whiskey? Homo Naledi's didn't drink whiskey. Why would we?
Whiskey, it's been around forever.
Forever? Yeah, if you mean in the form of water, yeast, and grain.
Google it. Whiskey. Forever. Homo Naledi.
We don't have the internet out here. Want to fool around?
Okay.